from WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Alec Ross. He is a Democratic candidate for governor of Maryland. Joining us in studio right now is Peter Newsham. He is chief of the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia. Chief Newsham, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Chief Newsham, you may or may not want to participate in the first couple of topics that Tom and I will be discussing. It is your choice. Tom Sherwood.
Let's don't leave it that wide open.
Maybe we can force him to get in on this one, because at-large council member David Grosso is proposing that the District of Columbia change how it refers to its top elected officials. He has introduced a bill under which the mayor of the city would be called governor, the members, the council would be called a legislative assembly, the council members would be called representative. It did not call for any similar upgrade for the chief, but presumably he will be head of the city's security at that point.
Well, there are the jobs, state police commissioners, all types of jobs, but I think you're happy with chief.
Chief,
I did the story when Grosso first let the bill be known a couple of weeks ago. I did it, you know, and it's got, on one hand, it gets some derision, people who think little of the district as a ward of the federal government, which it's not, of course. The citizens voted for statehood last year in a referendum or initiative, whichever it was, and it would just assign titles to the type of work they do. The fact is, the mayor of the District of Columbia has virtually all the titles that duties that a governor has. Cannot call out the National Guard. You have to go through the Attorney General of the United States for that. But beyond that, she does everything that a governor would do.
And the council members,
when people call it a city council, it just makes my skin crawl.
They do not call themselves a city council.
Well, sometimes they actually lapse and do it, but this is part of their own dignity being built up. But they have city, county, and state functions. They deal with all the issues that any state does, and in many cases do it better than some states. And so that's why Grosso says the ultimate goal is statehood. No one thinks in any shape or form or near statehood. But he says, let's call our elected officials what they are.
Well, and there are those who feel that calling our officials what they are, especially in the current political environment and the broader Washington, would only attract the attention and bring out the anger of those representatives who are opposed to statehood in the District of Columbia, who now constitute a majority in the House, Senate, and for that matter, the White House.
Well, the Republican House and the Republican Senate is not at all hospitable to having the district become a state. Not least of reasons is because if there were a state, there'd be two Democratic senators in the Senate, and that would cause a few problems with the Republicans.
In Virginia, President Obama has announced that he will be stumping for Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam in the governor's race that's coming up there in November. Northam, at this point, leads his opponent by some 8 percentage points, 47% to 39% for Ed Gillespie. Do you think it'll make a significant difference for President Obama to campaign for Northam in Virginia?
Well, yes, because President Trump is very unpopular in the state of Virginia.
And Obama won it twice.
Yes, but I went to the Republican convention in Cleveland last year when Trump got the nomination, and there was hardly any support in the Virginia delegation among Republicans for Trump. They were kind of accepting him. They all had been for Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush or somebody else. President Obama retains a great deal of support among African-American communities, progressive communities. You know, Ralph Northam won. He beat Tom Perriello in the primary a lot stronger than people expected. But Northam has said he's going to run for governor, as if he's 10 points behind, not 10 points ahead. And certainly Obama will probably make one or two appearances, and it'll be terrific for the Democrats.
On to our guest, in case you're just joining us. Tut, tut. Our guest is Peter Newsham, chief of the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia. Questions or comments, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Chief Newsham, this week the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the MPD on behalf of four individuals, including a journalist, who say they were illegally detained and mistreated by D.C. police officers amid Inauguration Day protests. They were among more than 200 arrested that day who, because this is D.C., they're being prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. But this lawsuit says MPD officers performed invasive and humiliating searches and denied those arrested access to water and bathroom facilities. What's the MPD's response to these allegations?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to have to give you the typical answer that someone in my position gives in government, is that we can't talk about a pending lawsuit. But I do think it's really important that folks know some facts about Inauguration Day. In 2016, the Metropolitan Police Department handled almost 1,000 First Amendment assemblies. So far this year, we've handled another 600. So we're on pace this year to handle more than we did the prior year. We do it better than any other police department does in the country. When people want to come here and peacefully exercise their First Amendment rights, we welcome them. We facilitate them. On January 20th of this year, when the President of the United States was inaugurated in Washington, D.C., we had tens of thousands of protesters in the city who came here and peacefully assembled and demonstrated. Many of those folks actually did break the law. An example is thousands of them were protesting down the Southeast Southwest Freeway, which is illegal. We did not make any arrests for any of the protesters or any of the demonstrators. We had about 200 people that came to the city with the intention of breaking the law, of destroying property. And I think we've all seen the images of what they did do, very disturbing images of windows being smashed, cars burning, rocks being thrown at police officers. When the dust settled, six of my police officers were in the hospital. One of my police officers was actually knocked unconscious by a piece of steel that was thrown at his head, dented his helmet, knocked him unconscious. Unfortunately, we had to make some arrests. We had to restore order. It's our responsibility to restore public safety here in the city. We made those arrests in a very respectful way. None of the people who were arrested was injured. A grand jury of their peers handed down indictments for three separate charges against those folks who were arrested. And that is going to play out in the criminal, you know, through the criminal process. You know, we were in a very difficult position in that we had to restore order in a very chaotic situation very clearly. I think some folks have suggested that the Metropolitan Police Department, it's a very small group of people, rounded up protesters or demonstrators and indiscriminately arrested them.
Journalists and legal observers were in the group that was arrested.
They were. And so people have suggested that, you know, the Metropolitan Police Department indiscriminately rounded up protesters and demonstrators on that day, and nothing could be further from the truth. The Metropolitan Police Department arrested rioters on that day, and we felt that we had that obligation to keep the city safe.
Do you think you made any mistakes? Have any officers been disciplined based on actions around those arrests?
To the extent that there was any mistakes made, I have told everyone that we will carefully look at that. We hold the principle of being able to, you know, exercise your First Amendment rights in Washington, D.C. to be sacred. I think that, you know, if you look at Washington, D.C., the Metropolitan Police Department's action with regards to First Amendment assemblies in 2016, the 1,000 or so that we had, the 600 or so that we've had this year, it would be inconsistent with our past and current behavior to suggest that we would indiscriminately round up protesters and arrest them. I think it's also important to note that I think it really actually challenges our notion of common sense to say that the Metropolitan Police Department did that on that day.
Tom Sherwood.
As I understand it, the police closed an area where all the where the violence was occurring and tightened the circle around that, and then they had people arrested.
I can't talk about the arrests in detail, okay, Tom, but I can tell you that's the narrative that some have suggested.
That's not true.
And it's just not true. You know, there were folks that were out there. They were breaking windows, not, you know, small windows. They were breaking store business front windows. Right. They were burning cars. They were throwing bricks and rocks at human beings' heads.
Let me just finish
because I feel very passionately about this. For someone to suggest that the Metropolitan Police Department just went up out there and rounded up a bunch of innocent protesters and demonstrators when that was going on and we saw it with our own eyes, it just doesn't make any sense.
I didn't mean to suggest that you just took a random group of people and corralled them off. But these people, the protesters who were violent and the anarchists who came here with the intent of disrupting, were moving up and down the street, K Street, where they were, Elster, I can't remember exactly. But part of the deal was to close in on them while they were doing this moving. And then some people who – did you give the people who were not involved a chance to leave, or did you have to check them all? I think that was one of the complaints
journalists. What we did is –
we had a reporter, I think, who was briefly in the mix, and she had her ID card and all that, and she wasn't
right.
Detained.
And what we did is when we did have folks stopped, we tried to identify anybody who might be a journalist. We're not in the business of arresting people who are legitimately out there covering the news story. And as you know, there was a Channel 4 reporter that was subsequently identified and released.
Let me go back to the law. Let me just touch on what Kojo had said too,
because there were some reporters that later identified themselves as journalists. We have actually gone back and looked at the body worn camera footage. Those folks were asked at the time, and they didn't indicate they were journalists at the time. So we did not know that they were journalists. And when they were found to be journalists, the U.S. Attorney's Office dismissed the charges.
So that'll all play out in the legal system now. I think it's important for people to know, to go back to Pershing Park, and was it 2002, where there was, and the city ended up paying $10 or $11 million in damages because there was a roundup of people that was less discriminate than what the police department now has changed its tactics.
They have
changed its training to be more flexible.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because D.C. has in effect become the protest capital of the country, probably has always been. And while few have been as large as the Inauguration Day protests, it's an ongoing reality here. This weekend, for example, three groups have asked for permits, an alt-right group, a splinter group that broke off from that group, and a third anti-hate group opposing the other two. What's the MPD's role in preparation for protests and large gatherings on the Mall? And what about park police, given that the Mall is part of the National Park Service?
Yeah, we do a great job here in Washington, D.C., of coordinating with our federal partners, particularly the park police. Frequently, these demonstrations and protests will go between MPD area that we have jurisdiction and then areas where the park police has jurisdiction. And because we do so many and because we have them all the time, we do it pretty seamlessly. Our last resort in any First Amendment assembly here in Washington, D.C., is to avoid making arrests. I think you all saw what happened during the Pride March. Mm-hmm. We had a small group of demonstrators. They got in the way of the parade, and they actually tied themselves together with a chain, and they blocked the parade route. And so the Metropolitan Police Department, I mean, that's illegal activity. We didn't have to make any arrests. We rerouted the parade around the group, so they were able to come here, peacefully exercise their First Amendment rights. And actually, if you talk to most folks about the Pride Parade, it was one of the biggest ones I think we've seen in Washington, D.C.
Some of the people protesting that parade were objecting to corporate sponsorship. They were also objecting to Metropolitan Police officers participating in the parade. And I know you have an LGBTQ liaison unit within the MPD. How did you feel about that?
Well, you know, you don't feel good about it when anyone suggests that they don't want the police to participate in such a kind of sunset.
They didn't even want you to have officers assigned to the street closings. This was a very – I don't want to denigrate a small group as being small and not important, but they're – arguments that corporations shouldn't have been involved in the parade, that the police officers, out police officers, should not be marching in the parade, or there shouldn't be police officers on the street. I mean, it tells me that we're in a – it's like people demonstrating against Trump. Your police department now has a lot of – from the far right to the far left, people coming to this town, whether
shooting a congressman in Alexandria or what.
It seems like a much tenser time for your officers. How do you get them ready for all of that?
You know, it's disposition. It's,
hey, listen to this broadcast. That's what they did.
And it's attitude. And, you know, the Pride Parade, I actually participated in the Pride Parade, and it was my wife and I walked in the parade, and it was a fun event. And I think at the end of the day, regardless of how some people felt, I was very proud of the fact that our special liaison unit did participate in the parade. The majority of the folks wanted the police to be there. You know, as
they were applauding and taking pictures. I was at 17th and Q watching the parade. It was 17th and R.
And you know that our special liaison unit, when they came through, got a lot of accolades from a lot of folks out there. You know, people are always going to have differing views, and I think that's the beauty of Washington, D.C. This is a place where you come. And I think that's the message that we try to send to folks. If you want to come here and peacefully express your dissatisfaction with anything, even if it's the police department, we're going to facilitate your ability to do that.
Well, several people would like to weigh in on this. So please put on your headphones, gentlemen, because first we will hear from Patricia in Washington, D.C. Patricia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call, Coach. I wanted to say that she's been doing a wonderful job on deflecting, because the issue of questions, he started out by saying he couldn't talk about the case, but then he...
We can't hear you very well, Patricia, so I'm going to put you on hold while I go to someone else who apparently shares your sentiments. Kathy Henderson, who represents ANC 5C. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Nandi. It's Commissioner Kathy Henderson, ANC 5D05. Very quickly, I just want to applaud Chief Newsom for his wonderful leadership. I was out there on inaugural day trying to get through the checkpoints when individuals became very, very disruptive, you know, and it was really terrifying. You know, I had a very good conversation with so many people that supported our president. We were talking and all of, at the Secret Service checkpoints, and all of a sudden, you know, there was this very angry mob surrounding us. And I can tell you that I unequivocally support First Amendment rights, but you do not have a right to come here, terrorize our city, injure our officers, break our windows, set fire to vehicles. When I actually got to the Wilson Building, you know, I was actually looking at cell phone video from other commissioners where people were out there attacking our officers, causing mayhem and setting fires. That is unacceptable.
Thank you very much for your call. There's a different point of view from William in Adams Morgan. William, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to talk about my experience on Inauguration Day. I was one of those peaceful protesters at the inauguration. I believe we were on 16th and K. I was standing in front of the entrance with several friends holding hands. Not to block.
And what happened?
People.
We don't have a lot of time.
Sure. So there was a police officer that pushed me three times from behind me, to the extent that I didn't even know it was a police officer pushing me. I thought it was just the crowd moving. Other police officers had to step in and tell him to calm down and leave me alone. Further, I think that the police chief's characterization of the tens of thousands of protesters that did come on that day as people who burned cars and broke windows is disingenuous, because there was only one small group that did that. Everyone else was peacefully assembled, and focusing on that kind of diminishes the fact that the police overreacted.
No, I think I'm pretty sure that the chief did not say that there were tens of thousands of people who were participating in disruptive
activity. No, I know, but tens of thousands of people, and then he focusing on one small group that set fire to one car.
Police, Chief Newsom?
I would say to William, you know, William, if you feel like there was police misconduct, then you should come forward, and you can either report it to us or you can report it to the Office of Police Complaints, because we don't tolerate our police officers mishandling anybody under any circumstances. So I would urge you to do that. And I think Kojo said correctly that on Inauguration Day, and this is the point that I was trying to make, there were tens of thousands of people who came to our city and peacefully demonstrated. There was a small group that came here and essentially rioted. And, you know, the police were put in a position where they had to restore order under those circumstances. A grand jury has subsequently indicted the people that were arrested on that day, and we'll let the criminal justice system handle the rest.
Can we talk about guns, the members of Congress carrying guns? We had a shooting in Alexandria. A couple of members of Congress, one from Alabama, I think one from Kentucky. There are all kinds of efforts up on the Hill to do away with the city's gun laws, and which are very similar to Maryland's, and just let people have concealed permits. And this congressman from Alabama wants to allow all members of Congress to carry guns in the District of Columbia.
And we got a tweet from D.C. for Gun Safety who says, I would love to know Newsom's thoughts on the newly proposed gun legislation, specifically concealed carry and semi-automatic.
I just want to make it clear, though, this Alabama congressman who wants to carry a gun doesn't want to carry one in the Capitol. And
yes,
I think if we have guns carried, let's have them in the Capitol, too. But your thoughts, Chief, not mine.
You know, I've said this over and over again, and I talk to folks from all over the city, that the number one thing that's contributing to violence in our communities is illegal firearms. I tell people all the time, you know, when somebody pulls the trigger of a firearm on the streets of the District of Columbia, usually two lives are destroyed. The person who gets hit by that bullet and the person who pulls the trigger. We have laws in the District of Columbia that I am very comfortable with. Those laws afford people the opportunity to have a firearm legally in their homes. Those laws also afford people the opportunity to carry a firearm under certain circumstances. I do think it's a little peculiar that we had an event in Virginia, which is one of the most liberal states with regards to the possession and carrying of firearms, and somehow that wants to be transposed into changing the laws and the rules in the District of Columbia.
Which is what Brian apparently in D.C. would like to ask about. Brian, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
All right. So my question for that is, I mean, obviously Alexandria is not too far from D.C., and there's been incidents in the past like this happening, of course, in different areas. But why can't district citizens have weapons as easy as, like, as congressmen if this does happen? Because if you look at it like this, like, you have all these congressmen saying, well, we want to carry guns in the district. Why can't there be legislation to have citizens have an easier time to get these guns? Because, I mean, of course, what the reason to carry or the rule for the CCW was, you see from your perspective district citizens getting guns easier now or having their Second Amendment rights less infringed than they are right now?
Chief Newsom?
I think I'm very comfortable with the state of affairs with the gun laws in the District of Columbia right now. I don't think we need special provisions for any category of persons. Right now, you can have a firearm in your home in the District of Columbia if you're inclined to do that. And you can also apply for a carry permit if that's something you're interested in as well. We do have restrictions regarding carrying here in the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia is uniquely in a very unique circumstances in that we're very small. You have, high-profile heads of state, the President of the United States, Congress that travel throughout our city on a regular basis. I think you need to have some consideration for their safety when they're traveling to and from the city. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, I'm very, very comfortable with the laws that we have in the district. It's just peculiar to me that we have an incident happen in Virginia and somehow somebody decides that because something happened in Virginia, we need to change the laws in the District of
Columbia. Congressman Massey of Kentucky, I remember now what he wants to do. He wants any concealed carry permit issued in the United States to be valid in the District of Columbia. So that, I think you don't need to answer. It's the same answer you gave before.
It is.
But that would be extraordinary if that were allowed.
There is a new campaign to combat thefts from cars. You might just see what looks like a pink ticket on your windshield. What is it, really?
I like that, actually. It's a reminder to folks to not leave valuables visible in your car. We do have a challenge with theft from autos here in the district. I think our numbers are fairly good, but if you've ever...
They're like 7% last time I checked.
If you ever, go out to your car after you've parked and most of us have very, very busy schedules, you go out to your car and your window's broken and your property has been taken from your car, there's no more frustrating experience than that. So what these pink tickets are really trying to do is just to give some advice to folks to try not to leave valuables in the car. I always hate the idea of blaming the victim, and in no way, shape, or form are we trying to do that, blame folks when they become the victim of a crime. But as a police department, I do think that we have a responsibility to share helpful tips to folks, and that's the idea behind it.
I said facetiously in today's billboard that pink ticket could also give a heads up to near-sighted thieves who may not be able to see.
Actually, that's a pretty good idea. Can we ask about tasers? Mark, I guess I'm going
to. Go ahead.
Mark Seagraves from Channel 4 reported that you are looking to do a pilot program on tasers. Tasers have got a really bad reputation when police officers use them indiscriminately. I think Chief Lanier, before you, allowed some sergeants to carry them. I'm not sure what the policy is, but you're going to do a little broader program now. What, a taser rather than on the one side of your belt that's opposite of your gun so you don't get them confused?
Exactly.
But why do you need them?
Well, you know, actually under Chief Lanier, the discussion began about getting tasers for our police department. And so we've done a lot of research. And whenever you implement a tool like this, you have to research the tool. You have to develop policy before you implement it. And then, of course, you have to give training to your folks. So actually just this past week, we rolled out about 80 tasers. And so our plan right now...
For patrol officers?
For our patrol sergeants.
Sergeants.
So our plan right now is to get tasers for all of the sergeants on the police department. One of the good things about policing in the District of Columbia is we have a very small geographic area. We feel very comfortable that if the sergeants have the tasers and the taser is needed on a particular scene, that we can get a sergeant there quick enough to be able to deploy the tool. And really the idea behind... giving the officers different options is to give them something that they can use as a tool to bring somebody into custody safely without having to resort to the firearm. So sometimes your officers will come across a very combative person who they have to take into custody, and the taser can be a very effective tool in bringing that situation under control. Another thing about the taser that a lot of folks don't know and probably should is that before an officer is going to deploy the taser, they're required to give a warning that you're about to be tased. And they also have the ability with that particular tool, if you pull the trigger, you can give it, it emanates a sound, which signifies to the person that, hey, wait a minute, they're actually really going to use this thing. And I think most people have an idea of what the taser does. It puts electronic bolts into the body, and you know, your muscles, they can't react, and you fall to the ground. It's not a pretty sight. It's a tool we would prefer not to use. But by and large, that tool does not result in deaths. It can under some very extreme circumstances. But by and large, it's a.
We only have about 2 minutes left, but and this is complicated, so that's why I mentioned the time. Last week, district officials charged several members of the Turkish security detail authorities, which they say attacked protesters outside the ambassador's residence last month. 9 people were injured. We know what happened that day. A lot of protesters were attacked by Turkish security, but what was the MPD's role during the protests and in intervening to stop the violence, and how is that complicated by the fact that this happened at a facility that at which some people have diplomatic immunity?
Yeah, I think most of us saw what happened because it was out there on video. It was some pretty violent assaults on peaceful demonstrators. And going back to our initial discussion about the Metropolitan Police Department and you know, our desire to make sure that people can peacefully assemble here in the District of Columbia. You know, when we saw that happen, our first response, again, was to restore order. We had as many as 9 people that were injured and had to go to the hospital as a result of that assault. So then the officers had to make sure that we got these folks the appropriate medical attention. We made 2 arrests on the scene. Very shortly thereafter, we went out and we said that we were going to hold the people accountable who were responsible for those assaults. I think the assaults as being individual assaults on particular people, but also it was an assault on everything that we stand for here in America and Washington, D.C., and that's your ability to protest you know, the government. So I was actually very proud and very happy you know, with the Secret Service and the State Department for cooperating with us in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And making sure that we got the warrants for everybody that was responsible. I think we've identified just about everyone that was involved in those attacks. And I think that's the appropriate way to handle a situation like that. Restore order, get folks medical attention who need it, and then follow up with warrants if they're necessary.
One last question as you go out the door. Rank and file are back up again for another contract with the union. Now, Chief Lanier often on this program would say, I'm not handling that. I'm just giving advice on what I think should be done, but I'm not doing the negotiation. I'm not doing that. And years went by, and it really, I think, hurt the morale of the police department. Are you going to approach union negotiations differently, more aggressively, so you can make certain that your officers are properly and fairly compensated?
Yeah, Chief Lanier was right. Pay and benefits is negotiated by the Office of Labor Relations and Collective Bargaining. It's not negotiated by the police department. We negotiate working conditions, and it's a joint effort that we are involved in with the Office of Labor Relations. So with that being said, our contract actually ends. The current contract ends on September 30th of this year. So we are not past due in our collective bargaining efforts. I'm hopeful that, management and labor can come to an agreement on raises. You know, we have
one. You put your thumb on the scale.
We have, and I'll say this to anybody, and I think a lot of people would agree, some may not agree, but we have a really good police department here in Washington, D.C. It's one that we all can be very proud of. People don't join this profession to get rich. I think that the way that we reward our officers is by recognizing the good work that they do. So in this, when we go into these contract negotiations, we do it with a very positive, hopeful, idealistic approach, hoping that we can get through them successfully and that everybody's happy at the end.
We hope so.
Peter Newsham is chief of the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We have him in a sweat box today. The air conditioning is not doing too good.
This is true.
Make our questions even tougher for the next guest.
You can't get arrested for having a hot room. You know that. We'll be shortly joined by Alex Ross. He's a Democratic candidate for governor of Maryland. If you have questions or comments for him, you can start calling now. He is running for governor. Also announcing this week, Tom Sherwood, is Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker. We have been speculating forever about when he's going to jump into the race. He made the mistake of not making the announcement on this broadcast, but he's made it anyway.
He'll be banned from this show, maybe.
Yes. Don't come back, Rashern.
No, he did put out a video, and in seriously, he did mention his wife and the time he spends with her for her early onset Alzheimer's. He mentions his stewardship of Prince George's County, which on many levels has done much better while he has been the county executive. And so we're going to see if he went up to Baltimore to campaign in the Lexington market, and he wasn't, our reporter who was with him said he wasn't very well known up there. So he's got some work to do to raise the money and to make himself known statewide, but he has to be considered a strong candidate.
But he was not the first to jump into this race. The first to jump into this race was Alec Ross. He's a technology entrepreneur and the author of the book Industries of the Future. He's a distinguished senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University. Alec Ross joins us in studio. What does this distinguished mean? Why are you not just a professor?
I don't know.
Why are you a distinguished senior
Distinguished
fellow?
Makes me sound older than I am.
What are you, 38? What?
I'm 45.
40? Oh, that's close enough.
I guess you get to be distinguished when you're 45.
Well, I think 45 qualifies.
My daughter thinks I'm old enough, pointing out the flecks of gray in my hair.
There you go. Well,
we have a super distinguished resident analyst here. You were the first Democrat to jump into this race. What would you say are the biggest issues facing Maryland, and what would you bring to the office of governor to address those issues?
Well, big issue number one, in my opinion, is education. I think that talent is everywhere, but opportunity is not. I was a sixth grade teacher in inner city Baltimore. And 20-some years after that, was working in the White House Situation Room as a presidential appointee for Barack Obama. And I got to tell you, Kojo, I got to tell you, Tom, the kids who I taught in West Baltimore, I know they were given the same God-given talent as the people who are sitting at the White House Situation Room with me, but they just had different opportunities. So the thing that is really driving this run for governor for me is the view that we need to enable the rise of the rest. We need to bring prosperity into more zip codes and enable more people to compete and succeed in tomorrow's economy.
Those are very good sounding campaign sound bites, but what can the governor do to deal with the legislature? What could you do? What type of legislation? I realize it's early because you have to get elected first, but just what can the governor do differently than, say, what the governors have done in the past?
So there's a ton. So first of all, there's a $6.3 billion budget for K-12 education. It comes out of the state. There are things that we need to do to modernize the delivery of education in the state. Let me give you one example, and it's in the governor's power to do this. Right now, only 40% of schools in Maryland offer at least one computer science class. This despite the fact that computer code is the alphabet that much of the future is going to be written in. Under a very reasonable cost, that number can go to 40% to 100%. And sure enough, the 40% of schools that do offer a computer science class are the wealthiest schools in the state. The governor has the power to extend that statewide. There's one very concrete example. Concrete example number two. There's $1.3 trillion worth of student debt in the United States. It's crushing the early careers of people just getting out of college. I'm in favor of our doing a project in the state of Maryland where we take student debt. If you went to the University of Maryland system, if you went to a public or private school in the state of Maryland, to get into an income share agreement so that instead of getting out of school with $100,000 of debt, you can sign a contract where you can say, for the next 10 years, I will give you X percent of my income. And at the end of the 10 years, whether you've been a kindergarten teacher or whether you've worked for a law firm, you're free of your debt.
A year out from the primary in Maryland, and the field on the Democratic side is already crowded. You've launched a tech startup. You served in the Obama administration, working for then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as a senior advisor on innovation. But unlike two of the candidates, and this is what they're likely to say when you make proposals about what you can do as governor, they'll say this guy has never held elective office. How would he know about this? What, in your experience, do you think would make you counter that argument?
So first of all, I think this is a good thing. I don't think a history working as an elected official is necessarily what we need in the office of governor right now. I think we need new faces with new ideas. I've had government experience. I've worked in the senior ranks of the federal government at the State Department, have run massive programs in government, so I know how government works. But I'm not its creature. I didn't spend my entire life walking the hallways of Annapolis or of a county executive office. And I think that's good. And I think that business owners—
Is it bad for Ashern Baker to walk the halls of the council in Prince George's County?
I don't think it's bad, but I don't think it's bad that I haven't spent my career doing it. I think that, you know, transcendent leaders oftentimes have a working knowledge of a field, but haven't become institutionalized by it.
Well, politics is the only profession, it seems, where voters often want to go get someone who has no experience. Now, you have federal experience, and that's a good thing. But it's odd to me that people will say, I want somebody who has no experience to be governor or president, as we now have right now, somebody who's never had elected of office. We just saw Tom Perriello, who had been a one-term member of Congress in Virginia, kind of run without any real knowledge. He didn't know who the new Speaker of the House was in Virginia and things like that. And he didn't fare so well. You're going to run against some people who have depth of knowledge about how this huge bureaucracy of a state government works. And good ideas don't go anywhere unless you can get, you know, the state Senate President Mike Miller to go along with you. Or he's been the president of the Senate, I looked it up, since 1987. Of what year were you born?
I was born in 1971.
Okay, not too far. And then Mike Bush is the House Speaker. He's been the House Speaker since 2003. Good ideas often hit dead ends when they hit a legislature.
Well, and when
deal with that issue?
And when you've got a Republican governor, what you've got is a dead end. You've got a General Assembly that does not work well with the governor. I think that while I do think that you need checks and balances between the executive branch and the legislative branch, what you do need is a governor who's able to work with the legislature. And being a Democrat and having having both business sense but Democratic values, I think is going to resonate a whole lot more in Annapolis than the contention, than the really unproductive fights that have taken place there the last couple of years.
Back in 2010, when you were named one of the 50 politicos to watch by Politico, and that was 2010, had you contemplated running for public office? When did this idea germinate in your head?
Well, you know, look, I think I've thought about running for office for a long time, but I didn't think about running for the office of governor of Maryland until after Donald Trump was elected. And the reason for that is because I think that there's a real distance between the governing and the governed. And when I – look, I grew up in coal country. I taught in inner city Baltimore. And I know that people are angry in our working class communities and in our low-income communities. And what propelled me into this race was a belief that people in those communities need people in office who really hear them and can drive solutions for them. And so, no, I was not planning on running for office, but I think that a positive byproduct of Trump's election is that some of us are saying, look, the biggest thing most important thing we can do is not make money. It's to get back into public service.
A number of Democratic leaders, and now you clearly among them, have taken firm stands against the policies of President Trump, vowing to uphold the Paris Climate Agreement, D.C. and Maryland's attorneys general suing the president under the Emoluments Clause, affirming sanctuary city status. One exception has been Maryland's current governor, Larry Hogan, who, even though he's no fan of President Trump, has not publicly opposed him on the issues. You've made comments to the media, including describing some of the president's recent behavior as full-on banana republic territory. What kind of stand would you take as governor of Maryland policy-wise with regard to the Trump administration, and do you think that's going to be a factor in this race?
I'll tell you what. When you drive under a sign that says, "Welcome to Maryland," if I'm governor, you're entering the resistance. Nothing appalls me more about Larry Hogan than the silence from him since Donald Trump has been elected, when really malignant policies are coming out of Washington. And that's going to change. I don't know the degree to which that is going to drive the election in 2018 or not. But what I do know is that as Trumpism infects Maryland, if Larry Hogan does not disavow Donald Trump, it's not going to help him.
Well, he was, you know, the Democrats and others tried during his election to get him to be critical of Trump last year. And I mean, Hogan just refused to do it. You did tweet this, I think, in this past week that you were criticizing Governor Hogan for going to Paris and London on a trade mission while Congress was salting the health care. I can't remember the exact words of it. But wouldn't you, as governor, want to go on trade missions to help the state?
Why did you
do that tweet?
Yeah, if you look at what I tweeted, I did not criticize his being in Paris. I do hope he's having a lovely time in Paris. I didn't criticize him for being there. What I did do is say, hey, dear Larry Hogan, while you're in Paris and London, you should be aware that your fellow Republicans are wrecking havoc on our health.
But he's the governor working on state issues. He has no vote on the – what would you have him do, not go on that trade mission?
I would have him do what other Republican governors have done, which is speak out very loudly against this Republican-cooked health care bill. And, oh, by the way, it is kind of the job of the governor to administer these health care programs. For example, if Trump Care goes through, you want to know how many Marylanders are going to lose their health insurance? Over 300,000. I think it's the job of the governor to care about that and engage on those issues. So, yeah, you know, go to Paris, you know, try to sell some airplanes. But if more than 300,000 Marylanders are going to lose their health care, speak up.
Tom, put on your headphones because we are about to hear from Luke in Silver Spring. Luke, your turn. Luke, you're on
hey.
The air.
I'm on? Okay, great. I have to ask about gerrymandering in Maryland. I think that gerrymandering is one of the biggest threats to democracy, and it does disproportionately advantage Republicans across the country. But Maryland, I'm a Democrat, but I still am strongly opposed to the way that Maryland's map is torn up.
The Supreme Court will be hearing an important gerrymandering case, Wisconsin, on how much partisanship is too much in drawing districts, and that will obviously affect Maryland. Alec Ross, I don't know anybody who disagrees that Maryland is a gerrymandered state.
Maryland's congressional districts look fairly ridiculous. But, I mean, here's the thing. There has to be a 50-state solution to this. What you're not going to get is the Democratic Party or the Republican Party unilaterally disarming in any given state. So in Maryland, look, I would be lying if I pretended that we weren't gerrymandered. We are. But by the same token, in Ohio, Barack Obama won the state of Ohio, I remember, and only like 5 out of the 18 congressional seats were won by Democrats. Why? Because it was so wildly gerrymandered. There has to be a 50-state solution to this.
Where do you fit? Some anticipate that this race is going to be bringing out divisions in the Democratic Party in Maryland between the establishment and the more progressive wings. Where do you fit if that is indeed the case? What kind of candidate do you see as best positioned to take on the moderate Republican incumbent who also happens to be very popular?
And well, we just played this out in Virginia.
Yes.
The same issue.
Well, first, I'm not willing to concede anymore that Larry Hogan is an incumbent. As this health care bill is going through Congress, he appoints a Trump care fanboy to chair the state health commission. No. So he's a Republican. He's not a moderate Republican. Where do I fall in the field? I'm not really focused on the rest of the field. What I'm focused on is my own race. And I'm less concerned about left versus right than I am about up versus down.
All right. The minimum wage, let's be specific, set to go up incrementally in Maryland, including a boost this July, eventually landing at $10.10 an hour next year. But there's a push for a $15 minimum wage, which at least two of your potential opponents have already come out in favor of. Where do you stand on it?
I'm in favor of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And the big reason for this is I don't care if 20 people get into this race for governor. I have a feeling I will be the candidate who's actually spent the most time working for minimum wage and not as some like class project. I needed to make that money when I was growing up in coal country. So this is a keenly felt issue for me. We need to get to $15 an hour.
How much were you making when you were working for minimum wage?
Gosh, it was like four something an hour when I got started.
When I first started, back right after World War II, I think, it was a dollar and a quarter. Here are the names of the candidates. Rashearn Baker. Do you know him? Have you ever met him?
I've shaken his hand.
Ben Jealous, a former NAACP guy.
I know who he is, but don't know him.
Congressman John Delaney.
I do know him.
Have you ever met with him or talked with him about the issues you've discussed?
Well, we've spoken about entrepreneurship. We were not, neither of us were in the
casual
race at that point.
Yeah. I'm just talking about in your professional life. Doug Gansler.
I know Doug.
Former Attorney General.
Yes.
Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz.
Have been in a room with him a handful of times, never met him.
State Senator Richard Madalino.
Yeah, I've testified before his committee in Annapolis and have spent time with him.
And James Shea, who is the former head of the Board of Regents for University of Maryland and head of the Venable Law Firm, he's thinking about being in there. All those are pretty established people with attributes. I don't want you to just rag on them because I don't think you would anyway. But why a newcomer like you when there's a lot of talent there?
So I think I add to the talent. I think it's actually good that Maryland has such a full slate of accomplished candidates. You know, among them, I'm the only one who's written a New York Times best-selling book about
Industries of the future.
I'm the only one who's started a company in a basement and grown it in to become a global organization.
Is that One Economy?
That's One Economy. I'm the only one who has run technology and media policy for a winning presidential campaign. I'm the only one who's been a public school teacher in an inner city. So, you know, I've got my own stripe in this, but I actually like that there's this much talent in the Democratic primary. Hopefully, we can actually have really thoughtful debates about the issues.
One of your issues in the book and your discussion is, in fact, that the robotics and the coding and the changing of the jobs, we've seen the disruption in the news business and now in the retail business across the board in states and the country. We've got to get on to how we're going to train for people for the future,
which is
part of your education issue.
Yeah, this scares me to death. And this can't all be about people who are going to go to fancy colleges. I'm really worried about those folks who aren't going to go to college. So one of the big planks in my campaign is technical education for non-college goers. You know, a lot of the jobs that are being eaten by software or replaced by artificial intelligence are, you know, manual labor. And as that gets eaten up, we need to make sure that our non-college goers have really strong trade skills that are not going to be replaced by robots.
We only have about 2 minutes left, time for Ethan to get his question. And Ethan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Ethan, are you there?
I'm there. Can you hear me?
We're almost out of time. Ethan, please make your question brief. Ethan, we can hear you.
I think we've lost him.
I think we have lost Ethan, which gives me the opportunity to ask the final question on the Purple Line, connecting Montgomery and Prince George's County, mired in legal issues. How important do you think this project is? How does it fit into broader statewide thinking on transit for you?
It's critical. Look, it's bananas that we don't have 16.2 miles of Purple Line here and the Red Line in Baltimore. No, you name one place in the world that regrets the investment that it made in mass transit. If we get the Purple Line back online, then we can really build economic wealth in Maryland independent of it just being close to Washington, D.C.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have, unless Tom has a question that's less than 20 seconds.
Well, back in 2010, you said, "I'm living in the moment," when you were named a Politico Top 50. Are you living in the moment?
I'm living in the moment, but I got my eyes on what's next.
Alex Ross is a Democratic candidate for governor of Maryland. He's a technology entrepreneur and the author of the book Industries of the Future. He's a distinguished senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you both.
That's it for the show today, but there's going to be a lot happening next week. If you're going to be roaming around the Smithsonian's Folklife Festival, I'll be there too. I'd like to see you. I'll be hosting a panel about ethics and media representation next Thursday at 3:30 p.m. at the Story Circle stage next to the National Museum of Natural History. You can find all the information about this at wamu.org/events, so come out next Thursday. Meantime, we'll meet you back here on Monday. We'll be exploring conversations taking place in local Muslim communities in the wake of a killing of a young Muslim woman last weekend in Northern Virginia. That's all at noon Monday. Until then, have a great weekend, and thank you all for listening. Any big plans for you this weekend, Tom?
I have my brother, who is a minister, staying with me this weekend. He's a very conservative minister, and I'm a media guy, so we'll have great conversations.
Hopefully he will be able to improve the quality of your spirituality.
Oh, we'll see.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.